From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Saturday Night Live veteran Al Franken. He created the character of Stuart Smalley, whose self-esteem is so low he's become addicted to 12-step programs. Franken wrote and stars in a new Stuart Smalley film that introduces us to Stuart's dysfunctional family. Imagine translating the concept of low self-esteem to the Dalai Lama. That's part of the job of the Dalai Lama's chief translator. He not only translates Western concepts for the Dalai Lama, he explains Buddhist concepts to Westerners. We'll meet the translator, Geshe Thupten Jinpa. He's a former Tibetan monk. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal jury in Washington has convicted Francisco Martin Duran of trying to kill President Clinton. Last October, Duran pulled a semi-automatic rifle from under his coat and fired more than 24 bullets at the White House before he was tackled by several tourists. NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
The jury deliberated for just a few hours. The panel rejected the arguments of Duran's attorneys that he shot at the White House because he was mentally disturbed. Defense lawyers said Duran fired his gun because he thought he saw a mist hovering over the presidential mansion and he wanted to save the world from it. But prosecutors said that argument was total nonsense, and they accused Duran of faking mental illness. The jury apparently agreed. The panel convicted Duran of all 10 counts against him, including trying to assassinate the president, assaulting 4 Secret Service officers, damaging federal property, and several weapons violations. Duran could be sentenced to life in prison. This is Laura Kanoy in Washington.
President Clinton has held a news conference with British Prime Minister John Major. They discussed items they've been talking about during a meeting in Washington. Leading the list was Iraq. Mr. Clinton says the United Nations should not lift its Gulf War sanctions against Iraq yet.
Unless Mr. Achaeus and the international inspectors can certify that they're in full compliance with all the relevant United Nations resolutions, then we have no assurance that they are not regaining the capacity to move forward with weapons of mass destruction.
The leaders also spoke of the peace process in Northern Ireland. Both have called on paramilitary groups there to lay down their weapons. Mr. Major is also calling on Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, to join talks on decommissioning group weapons.
We've already started discussions at ministerial level with the loyalist paramilitaries on decommissioning, and those discussions are proceeding. What we're seeking to do is to have exactly the same discussions on exactly the same terms with Sinn Féin. Now, if Mr. Adams is serious about moving towards peace, and he has repeatedly spoken about it, then he needs to discuss with the British government the question of the modalities of decommissioning the arms.
Both leaders say they're in agreement on several other international issues, including defusing the Bosnian crisis and maintaining ties with Russia. The Supreme Court of Maine has thrown out a gun ban at a public housing authority. The ruling was unanimous. It stemmed from a case in Portland where the housing authority had banned guns in its public housing projects. A lower court upheld the decision and called it a reasonable effort to protect residents. But the National Rifle Association challenged the ban, and Maine's highest court ruled that the state law bars the housing agency from regulating firearms on its own. The case is considered a test of the ability of housing agencies around the country to restrict firearms. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen 21 points to 4,189. This is NPR. The Senate has forwarded to the president a bill that grants some 3 million self-employed people a tax deduction for health care costs. The measure is retroactive to the 1994 tax year. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The bill allows the self-employed to deduct 25% of their health insurance premiums from their 1994 income taxes. The deduction, which had expired, would increase permanently to 30% next year. President Clinton is expected to sign the measure. Several provisions of the bill were at the center of controversies on Capitol Hill. Senate Democrats complained that the legislation dropped a provision from the earlier Senate-passed version that would have imposed a tax on wealthy Americans who renounced their U.S. citizenship. But Republicans said the measure had been hastily approved and unfairly discriminated against the wealthy. To help defray the cost of extending the health insurance break, the bill halts a tax break for companies that sell broadcast stations to minorities. That provision effectively kills Viacom's planned multi-billion-dollar sale of its cable television systems to a partnership that includes a minority member. Some Democrats tried to retain the tax preference for minorities, saying it was needed to help bring racial equality to the communications industry. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A published report says the Army has changed its mind and plans to award the Purple Heart to 14 victims of friendly fire. The Belleville News Democrat of Illinois reports the Pentagon will give the Purple Hearts to the American soldiers killed when U.S. pilots shot down two U.S. helicopters over an Iraqi no-fly zone last year. The Army had originally refused to award the honor because the soldiers didn't die in a hostile action, but the Illinois congressional delegation persuaded the Pentagon to reconsider. A wintry blast of Arctic cold has gripped the Midwest. Temperatures were forced into the single digits this morning. Minneapolis-St. Paul recorded a temperature of 8 degrees. Bismarck, North Dakota was 12 degrees. The chilly weather is now moving toward the East Coast. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of people suffer from low self-esteem. Saturday Night Live veteran Al Franken is the creator of the character Stuart Smalley, whose daily affirmations are meant to silence that inner voice that is always criticizing. Now Stuart is good enough and smart enough to have his own movie, which of course Al Franken wrote and stars in. It's called Stuart Saves His Family, and it introduces us to Stuart's dysfunctional family. Al Franken was part of the initial Saturday Night Live team and has worked with the show as a writer and performer for all but 5 of its 20 years. Stuart Smalley, as you may already know, is a caring nurturer, although not a licensed therapist, who dispenses advice on his cable TV show. He's a member of and even addicted to several 12-step programs.
Al-Anon, because, you know, for family members of alcoholics, thank you, Dad, for that one. My father is an active alcoholic, big stinking drunk, and, you know, OA, because I'm powerless over food, that's Overeaters Anonymous, Debtors Anonymous, because I have a lot of money issues. For example, I have difficulty spending money on myself. I'm an anorexic spender. So, you know, that's kind of me. I think you got some idea.
Al Franken, who is Stuart based on?
Stuart is sort of, was an amalgam. I go to Al-Anon, which is for family members and friends of alcoholics. And he's sort of, I created him out of a number of people I've met in Al-Anon who take it quite seriously. And maybe, and I take Al-Anon very seriously too, but I mean, who it becomes their entire life. And one thing I learned in Al-Anon, which is a pretty obvious thing, is that you can learn stuff from people who aren't necessarily smarter than you. I used to think that the only people you could learn from are, you know, people that are accredited as smarter than you, like professors and stuff, which is a pretty dumb idea. And I remember being in Al-Anon one day and hearing somebody share about, I shared about how hard it is for me to accept the idea of a higher power who is all-knowing and because of the Holocaust, because I was born in 1951 and I'm Jewish and I sort of had the Holocaust pounded into my head. And I shared at this meeting in a very heartfelt way about that. And the next person who stood up or who raised his hand said was called on, said, I just want to thank the higher power for putting an apartment in my life because it gave me the courage to leave my lover.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so, and then about a month later, so I thought this person was ridiculous, and about a month later, this person said something really, struck me, and it was really, made me understand something I hadn't understood before. And and part of what it made me understand was I could learn stuff from people who seem outwardly lame. So that's sort of why I created Stuart, someone who on the outside seems pretty lame, but you can actually learn something from him.
In the Stuart Smalley film, I won't give too much away here, but of course there's the question of will Stuart spend Christmas with his dysfunctional family or not? And since Passover is coming up, mm-hmm. I thought I'd take this opportunity to ask you to reminisce about what Seders were like. Seder is the Passover dinner. When you were young, I mean, for a lot of families, that's a time of like serious reflection. For some families, it's a time of serious bickering.
We would the bickering sort of won out. Mainly, the bickering was how quickly we'd go through the Seder.
Right, like how soon do you eat?
Yeah,
because the prayer part can take a long time, and
because my father was more devout than my mom.
Uh huh.
And so my mom wanted to hurry things along. And my dad wanted to take his time and tell the story of Passover. My dad talked like this. And she would go, Joe, we don't need to hear that. Oh, Phoebe. That was basically what our Seder was like and what every meal was like at our house.
Would you take sides?
I was the one who didn't take sides. I would stay out of it. I was the younger brother. And my brother would get involved in it. I sort of learned to, like, smooth things over. That's my role, in the house.
So how would you smooth things over at the Seder?
By being funny.
Making jokes about
religion, about
God?
The
Moses?
Afikoman.
about
the Afikoman.
That's the matzah that you hide. It's part of
That's right. I can't remember what my... I wish I could remember my Seder material. But I can't.
So you had to come to the Seder equipped with material, huh?
No, I would just, that was just the role I played in my family. I was sort of the comedian who made sure that people weren't mad at each other. And my brother played the role of egging everybody on. and the rebel. He lives in France now. He lives in Paris, my brother. He tried to get as far away from... our family as possible, but I'm close to him.
Al Franken is my guest, and he's been with Saturday Night Live for a long time, and is the creator of the Saturday Night Live character Stuart Smalley, who's now the star of a new film called Stuart Smalley Saves His Family, written by Al Franken, who also stars in it, of course, as Stuart Smalley. I'd like to go back to Saturday Night Live and mm-hmm. ask you about the very early days. I think you were there for the first show, is that right?
Yeah, I was there for the first 5 years. Uh-huh. Then I left for 5 years, and I've been back since 85.
What was the first really good sketch you wrote that got on the air?
I wrote a very black sketch, Tom and I wrote, about... this guy, remember this guy, what was his name, Dean Corliss or something, who had murdered, several, boys. He had, like, murdered, like, 13 boys or something, and some young boy had helped him murder these boys. And so the sketch I wrote was the boy calling home to tell his parents that he had been arrested, and they were going, we love you, son, we're behind you. What exactly, we know, whatever you did, you know, we know, you know, what are you charged with? Well, it's kind of serious. Well, we love you, son, and so it sort of reveals itself that their child had participated in this grotesque, gruesome, awful, hideous thing, and through the whole sketch, they just keep repeating, we love you, son. Whatever you did is okay with us, and we will get you the best lawyer. It was just, and it was funny, and it was very, very black.
So how did it go over?
It went pretty well. It went pretty well.
Now, when you wrote a sketch, would you try to get, say, John Belushi or Dan Aykroyd or whoever behind the sketch before presenting it to Lorne Michaels?
Well, what we do is the show works the same. Has worked the same for 20 years, which is you write it up for read-through. For example, today's Tuesday, and we have read-through tomorrow, Wednesday, so I'm going to be writing after I leave here. And a lot of times the performers just see the stuff at read-through. That's the first time they see it. Or you catch them maybe an hour before read-through and go over it with them.
So who's at read-through?
Rethru are all the writers and the performers, but also all the design people, the hair people, the makeup, the technical people, everyone who is involved in mounting any one of these sketches. So so that everyone's heard what the sketch is and knows, you know, what they have to do. The prop people are there, so they know what props to get. You know, sound people and the music, you know, sound effects, and everybody's there. The censor's there.
Do you still have a censor?
Yeah, we still have a censor. And, you know, we have a good relationship with our censor. We're a live TV show. We have to obey the censor. But they're pretty good. I think they allow some things on that shouldn't be on sometimes, and I think that they don't allow things on that should be on. But
have you had anything recently that wasn't allowed on that you liked?
I had something illegal killed last year that really made me mad.
What was it?
Well, I guess we can say it on the air. Last Easter, I went to Florida for vacation with my family, and I had to wait like 2.5 hours for a car at Alamo. So I wrote a sketch on the air, which was set at Alamo Rental Car with an E at the end. And it was just all about, the whole sketch was just me getting back at Alamo. And so in the sketch, they're going like, it was framed as if it was a commercial for Alamo, so someone in the sketch goes, "This is a strange commercial for Alamo. Everyone's waiting forever for their cars. Could it be that one of the writers on Saturday Night Live actually had a terrible experience with Alamo?" And so that was the premise of the sketch. It was documented, or I could document that I did, in fact, wait 2.5 hours. So this is finally my revenge a year later.
Isn't that everybody's revenge fantasy, where when you finally get the car, you say, "Do you have any idea who I am and how I can get back at you for this?"
I did mention that, actually.
Did you?
Yeah.
That was really small of you, don't you think?
It was very petty. And it was really funny sketch, and they were just very worried about a big...
Wait. Now let's back up. So when you said, "Do you know who I am?"
No, I didn't actually say that. I said, "You know, I am a writer." I just said something like, "I'm a writer for NBC, and I'm gonna, this may be on TV next week," and they didn't seem very impressed.
That hurts, huh?
No. What hurt was the NBC legal not allowing me to do this thing. Boy, and I spent so much time. NBC consulted the guy who, I can't remember his name, the lawyer who defended the New York Times on the Pentagon Papers, got involved in this thing. Well, I mean, it got very big. It got like...
Would you have done it and just changed the name?
Well, it wouldn't have made any sense. I think the whole joke was that it was Alamo with an E. The whole joke was that I was actually just getting my revenge. So to change it to another rental car company, which, by the way, legal had the same suggestion for me. Just change it to some other name. American Car Rental. No, the whole idea is that it's Alamo, you know. And
how is life at Saturday Night Live now different for you than it was when you started in 75?
Well, life is just different for me. I have two kids. I have a 14-year-old daughter and a 10-year-old son. And so I like to get home, you know. When the show first started in 75, from 75 to 80, doing the show was like submarine duty. You just never left it on a show week. And now I leave. But I also believe I know how to do the show better. So I can use my time a little bit more efficiently. It's different in that the cast is much bigger. There's a lot of things about the show that are problems that people have pointed out, and that we actually are not in denial about at the show. We understand there are certain problems, and one of the problems is there's so many people in the cast that it is it almost makes it harder to write. For the show. Anyway, I tend to, but in many ways the show is very, very much the same. I will be there till 3 or 4 in the morning tonight, probably, writing stuff for a read through tomorrow. Damon Wayans, our host this week, and we'll have a read through. And in many ways, it's the same process. I miss having, like, Dan Aykroyd hosted our last show, and he was brilliant, and it was really brought back. I wrote a lot with Danny when he was on the show, and he's really the consummate live television performer. So I miss some of the old cast, but I think there's a lot of talent in our new cast. It's just there's so many of them that people don't really get a chance to do a lot on the show. So, and also it enables someone to get away with doing one or two things, and that's all they feel they have to do.
Al Franken of Saturday Night Live. He wrote and stars in a new movie about his character Stuart Smalley called Stuart Saves His Family. It opens April 12th. This is Fresh Air. We're fundraising this week. Stations around the country are asking their listeners to pledge with their support. And there are many things that you get from making a pledge, including the knowledge that you're helping public radio to stay alive during a very difficult time. But also, I think it would boost your self-esteem. Stuart Smalley, what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Maybe everyone out there should just do a little affirmation.
What would it sound like?
Oh, just, well, okay, everyone close your eyes, you know, unless you're driving. But say to yourself, hello, me. I love NPR, and I'm going to give. Because when I give, I get a good feeling about myself and about, you know, the airwaves. And I'm going to give, you know, not till it hurts, because, that, you know, I'm going to give till it feels good.
Stuart Smalley, thank you for that advice.
Oh, thank you.
We're featuring a special series this week about some of the small record labels that helped shape today's music. Progressive rock had its origins during London's psychedelic era. One label, founded in London by the heir to a fortune, recorded some of the most interesting rock music of the times and paid back his native land by giving us Bob Marley. Here's rock historian Ed Ward.
Homesickness has made for some great songs over the years, but seldom has it utterly changed the face of rock and roll. It's just possible, though, that if Chris Blackwell hadn't loved the land of his birth, Jamaica, so much, a lot of things would be very different today. Blackwell was born in Kingston in 1937, into the family that made Cross and Blackwell Marmalade, but the 60s saw him living in London. He'd always loved Jamaican music, and he'd produced a couple of local hits in his youth. In London, he discovered lots of Jamaicans drawn to Britain by the huge number of jobs available. They, too, loved Jamaican music, but it was hard to find. Blackwell decided to do something about it and started a record label. He called it Blue Beat, and right away he had a smash worldwide hit. My boy, lollipop, you made my heart go giddy up. You are as sweet as candy. You're my sugar dandy. Well, my boy, lollipop, you'll never, never leave me. Millie Small's childish voice and the irresistible beat of what would become known as ska managed to sell records even in the Beatle-infested year 1964. And before long, Blackwell was in business, putting out the latest Jamaican hits in Britain and changing the name of the label to Island. But there was another current flowing through London in the 60s. Things began to get psychedelic, and Blackwell took notice. One of the first rock signings at Island was Traffic, featuring the teenage prodigy Steve Winwood, who'd been the outstanding voice in the Spencer Davis Group. Blackwell's instincts were good. Traffic gave the label hits like Paper Sun and Dear Mr. Fantasy, and suddenly rock musicians were knocking on Island's doors. Producer Joe Boyd was among the hopefuls, and his folky instincts brought the label the incredible string band, Nick Drake, and perhaps most notably, Fairport Convention. With vocalist Sandy Denny and guitarist Richard Thompson, Fairport Convention was a British folk supergroup, and Island released many of their spin-off projects as well. Bands like Free, Jethro Tull, Blodwyn Pig, King Crimson, Mott the Hoople, and later artists like John Cale and Brian Eno kept Island in the forefront of progressive music in Britain. Blackwell, though, still had his heart in Jamaica. Since 1969, he'd been trying to break Jimmy Cliff as a rock star by having him record songs by another Island artist, Cat Stevens. But in 1972, he helped bankroll a film starring Cliff that would start another revolution, this time in the U.S. As hippies watched Jamaicans sucking down huge amounts of pot, reggae was introduced to America. Blackwell then readied phase two of his plan.
Dread not, be dread now. Dread like Congo Bongo. Not to dread like in a Babylon.
Although it was a stormy relationship, Chris Blackwell did everything he could to make Bob Marley and the Wailers stars in the U.S., even helping Marley by giving him the Blackwell Mansion at 10 Hope Road in Kingston. By this time, Island was one of Britain's major labels, and even had a U.S. branch. When punk came along, it didn't jump in with both feet, but recorded edgy music by Grace Jones and took a chance on a young band from Ireland that drew 9 people to their London debut.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go. One man come here to justify. One man to overthrow.
U2's ascendancy saw the end of Chris Blackwell's involvement. His attention was elsewhere, in movies and other projects. Island still exists today, but it's just another label, and Chris Blackwell's just another rich guy, having sold Island some years ago. Still, the past couple of decades would have been poorer without it.
Ed Ward is a writer based in Berlin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir. So that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelites.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, karma, renunciation, and enlightenment. We talk with Geshe Thupten Jinpa, the principal translator for the Dalai Lama. Jinpa is a former Tibetan monk who entered a monastery when he was 11. He says Buddhist concepts are often difficult to translate to Westerners, but he says there's one particular Western concept that the Dalai Lama finds absolutely incomprehensible. Find out what it is and stay tuned for more Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A federal jury has convicted Francisco Duran of trying to assassinate President Clinton. The jury took just a few hours to reach the verdict against the Colorado man. Duran's lawyers had argued he was insane when he fired at the White House late last October. He's been convicted of all 10 charges lodged against him, and he could be sentenced to life in prison. President Clinton welcomed British Prime Minister John Major to the White House today. They held talks and had lunch together before appearing at a news conference. They brushed aside recent tension in U.S.-British relations, which was triggered by a U.S. visit of an Irish nationalist leader. Mr. Clinton ignored objections by the British government and allowed Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams to raise funds and visit the White House. Mr. Clinton says he still agrees with British opinion that all sides in the Northern Ireland conflict must put aside their weapons for peace.
I was very clear when the Adams visa was granted with permission to fundraise that there must be an agreement, a commitment in good faith to seriously and quickly discuss arms decommissioning. Without a serious approach to arms decommissioning, there will never be a resolution of this conflict. And so I think that I would hope there'd be no difference in our position on that, because I think the Prime Minister's right about that. We have to deal with this arms decommissioning issue. And I know that there is an attempt by the government to work with the paramilitaries on both sides to achieve that objective, and that's what I think should be done.
Mr. Clinton says he and Mr. Major agree on many other pressing international matters. Maine Supreme Court has ruled that the public housing authority in the state cannot bar tenants from keeping guns in their home. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Radio reports.
The justices struck down the gun possession ban included in the leases signed by public housing tenants in Portland, the state's largest city. Housing officials had maintained that the gun ban helped reduce violence. But the restriction was challenged by the National Rifle Association on behalf of two tenants who argued they needed their guns for safety and recreation. Maine has some of the nation's most sweeping protections of gun owner rights, and the justices ruled the ban violated a state law that prohibits local governments from imposing their own gun control measures. This case had been watched by gun control advocates nationally. They'd felt that if a public housing gun ban could survive a court test in Maine, it could survive one in just about any state. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Portland.
The second U.S. Court of Appeals has denied a request by baseball owners to stay the injunction issued against them last week. The ruling clears the way for the season to start April 26th. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today, another record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 33 points to finish at a new close of 42.01. Advances led declines by a margin of 7-4 in very heavy trading. This is NPR. An Iraqi attorney has met with foreign ministry officials in Baghdad in a rather bid to win the release of two imprisoned Americans. The lawyer visited both men twice yesterday in a maximum security prison outside Baghdad. The visit opens an appeals process that will hopefully win their release. Iraq has extended the appeals period from 2 weeks to a month. The men have been jailed for illegally entering Iraq. Washington maintains both men accidentally crossed the border, but Iraq says the men had sinister motives linked to U.S. sanctions against Iraq. More than 100 people are dead in a small southern Philippines town after armed men robbed banks and burned buildings. Another 30 people were hurt when the gunmen traded fire with government troops. John Miller reports from Manila.
Witnesses say about 200 men arrived in buses and on small boats in a carefully planned attack on the town of Ipil, 480 miles south of Manila. The group carried out simultaneous raids on at least three banks and a department store. They also set fire to several of the town's major buildings. Among those killed were the local police chief and the head of the military battalion stationed in the area. The attack came during a period of intense campaigning and heavy spending for local and national elections next month. But so far, no motive has been established for the raid. A military spokesman says the attackers are former Islamic rebel fighters who have turned to banditry. Witnesses report that the group fled into a nearby forest, possibly with hostages. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Manila.
Officials with the National Archives say the glass protecting three of the country's most precious documents is starting to crack. Officials have found microscopic cracks in the cases protecting the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Officials at the archives say the documents are not damaged and they aren't in immediate danger, but they say there could be recommendations made by a special panel to keep them safe. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Buddhism has had a profound effect on the West, on everything from spiritual life to stress reduction. But much of what we hear about Buddhism is watered down, commercialized, or misinterpreted. My guest, Geshe Thupten Jinpa, was born in Tibet in 1958 and fled with his family to India after the failed 1959 Tibetan uprising against the Chinese occupation. At the age of 11, he entered a Buddhist monastery run by Tibetan monks in exile. For the past 9 years, he's been the chief translator for the Dalai Lama, the exiled spiritual and political head of the Tibetan people. Jinpa now lives in England, where he's been studying Western culture and philosophy so he can act as a bridge between the East and the West. He's just translated a new book of the Dalai Lama's called The World of Tibetan Buddhism. I asked Jinpa about the first time he met the Dalai Lama.
Well, I first met him when I was just a boy at the age of 7. I was in a kindergarten school and... Yeah, I may have been actually 5 or 6. And His Holiness visited the school. And I remember because I was chosen as the boy, you know, we had a boy and a girl, to offer him flower garland. So I was chosen as the boy.
Did that have an impact on you?
Definitely. And since then, I've always wanted to become a monk, because after that, I've had exposure to several monks. You know, I've met them mainly in the schools. They were teachers, and to me, all these monks have, you know, sort of symbolized a kind of a life of serenity. And they were all, you know, extremely compassionate and gentle yet strong. So for me, they have always been a kind of a, you know, hero.
I believe you decided when you were 11 that you wanted to go to a monastery and study to be ordained.
That's right. Actually, I was studying in a normal school in Simla, which is the northern part of India, which used to be the summer capital during the British Raj. Beautiful part of India. And somehow in the school, I didn't feel very contented, because from an early age, I've wanted to do something sort of, you know, deep and profound. And, you know, sort of I've always... enjoyed the intellectual challenge of thinking. And for me, monkhood represented a life of intellectual scholarship in pursuit of, you know, philosophy and scholarship. So at the age of 11, I left the school against my father's will. I mean, he was totally against it. He felt that by leaving school, I was... in some sense, wasting a wonderful opportunity to become a bread earner for the family, because, you know, refugee families, you know, they, you know, for them it was very important that their children go to school, go to university, get a job, and support the family. So my father was completely against it, but I insisted and joined the monastery.
Is it unusual for an 11-year-old to, on his own free will, join a monastery?
Yes, it is. Normally, what happens in the case of a monk is that at an early age, about 8 or 9, the parents would make the choice for the children to be sent to a monastery.
You know, it's interesting to me, you were attracted to the monastery because you wanted intellectual discipline. I remember when I was in college and I started reading some books about Buddhism, to me and to some of my friends, Buddhism seemed to offer an alternative to the intellectual approach to life. We thought of it as a way to kind of quiet your mind and to take your mind away from thought and thinking about thought and thinking about the history of thought. And so I'm interested that you are attracted to the intellectually rigorous aspects of the monastery.
Yes. Interestingly, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, intellectual scholarship is not really discouraged. In fact, Tibetan Buddhism perceives enlightenment or awakening, true awakening, in the form of a unity between rationality, which is our intellect, and intuition, and in some sense unifying them in the form of a mystical experience. So, of course, quietening the mind is an important part of the meditative practice. Yet at the same time, this is not the only path. So you have to combine the meditative approach of quietening the mind along with a rigorous intellectual philosophical analysis.
You know, most boys and girls who are 11, 12, 13, they're just so full of energy. They're just kind of bouncing around. It's very difficult for teachers to keep them focused, to keep young students focused on anything, especially when those hormones start to kick in.
That's true.
At around 13. So what was it like for you then to be in this discipline setting of the monastery?
Well, you know, intellectually speaking, it is rather, you know, it is quite disciplined. But I mean, if anyone has seen Buddhist monks debating in the debating courtyard, and by the way, much of the debating occurs outside in a courtyard, mm-hmm. and it's a very physical act. You know, it's almost like a sort of a dance, where you see, you know, monks standing and some sitting down and clapping and stamping their feet, and the debate and the exchange of the debate is very spontaneous, and often it is kind of a meditation, you know, while you are there, you know, physically and emotionally and also intellectually absorbed in this discourse, discussion with either one person or many people together in a group, you automatically get sort of transported onto a quite a different plane of mind. And there is definitely a lot of freedom and activity there. And I feel that, and also in the monastery, there is a much greater appreciation of the basic sort of, character of the human mind. There is no expectation of a monk just because he has taken a, you know, monastic vow. There is no expectation that he should act, completely holy or, beyond sort of, human capacity. So there is a much greater sort of humanity. There's much more humor and I would say just simple ordinariness.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Geshe Thupten Jinpa, and he's the translator for the Dalai Lama. And the new book that he's translated is called The World of Tibetan Buddhism. How did you become the Dalai Lama's translator?
Oh, it was actually quite interesting. I was at that time based in South India, studying in one of the monastic universities. And in 1985, I went up to Dharamsala, where His Holiness is based. This is in the northern part of India, which is quite far away, more than 1,000 kilometers away. And I went to see my sister, who was at that time in school there. And when I reached Dharamsala, it so happened that His Holiness was scheduled to give a series of teachings at the request of a group from Los Angeles from the next day. And the resident interpreter at that time wasn't in town. And, they were expecting him only a day after the teaching, would begin. So they were looking for someone to stand in for him just for a day. And the word got around that, I have a reasonably good command of English and also have a good, Tibetan philosophical monastic training. So I was approached, and at that time, I must admit that let alone having any sort of wish to translate for His Holiness, I even haven't dreamed of being able to do such a thing. So I said, look, I haven't done anything like that, and especially for His Holiness, I won't even have the guts to do it. and anyway, I was asked to do it, and then since then I've been working for him as his key interpreter. So it's mainly sort of different circumstances, and so it's more out of coincidence.
What's it like to be around him?
It is wonderful. Not only spiritually, it is extremely inspiring, but it is also deeply encouraging. And I personally feel whenever I'm traveling with him and working for him, I feel a tremendous sense of encouragement and also a boost in my own self-confidence. Because for me, he represents what is the best in the potential of human existence, what could be achieved as a human being, especially in terms of his discipline, in terms of his genuineness, in his compassion towards other fellow human beings, and also the spontaneity and the tremendous sense of confidence in his own mission and in his own ability to interact and touch people at the deepest level. And I find that, very inspiring.
My guest is Geshe Thubten Jinpa, and he is the translator for the Dalai Lama, and he's translated a new book by the Dalai Lama called The World of Tibetan Buddhism. Are there certain Buddhist concepts or stories that are particularly difficult to translate into English?
Yes, there are some concepts which are quite difficult to translate, and also which requires a certain degree of reorientation of one's own outlook, and also some concepts which have a potential for misunderstanding and misinterpretation. For example, like the doctrine of karma is sometimes misunderstood as a kind of a fatalistic doctrine, that because such and such a person has done some bad act in the past, the suffering that he's undergoing now is something that he deserves, and it is his bad luck. There is that potential for misinterpretation of some of the, basic ideas of Buddhism. Whereas if you look at the idea, the concept itself in its proper context, then you will see that there is no grounds for, reading such fatalistic sort of, interpretation into it.
Yeah, I think karma is often translated into the West as what goes around comes around.
Yes, that's right. And also some people think it's a fate, mm-hmm. whereas the actual original word karma has a much more proactive connotation, and literally it means action.
Are there Western ways of thinking that have been difficult for you to translate to the Dalai Lama?
I remember, generally speaking, His Holiness's English is very good. So luckily, I don't have to translate that much back into Tibetan. But I do remember once, this was quite a while ago in California, there was a conference on Buddhism and psychotherapy, a dialogue. And at the the conference, there were, panelists, all of whom were practicing psychotherapists or psychoanalysts. And the question of self-hatred and based on low self-esteem came up. And His Holiness, couldn't believe there is such a thing as self-hatred. He kept shaking his head, and he said, how come, everybody, at a deep down will love themselves, will be attached to themselves, would want to live, how is it possible? I mean, he felt that the very concept of self-hatred was in some sense incoherent. It doesn't make any sense. So I remember the panelist, spending at least 5 to 10 minutes trying to convince him that there is such a thing, that the concept is not only coherent, but there are people, who suffer from this problem. So that was one situation, you know, one incident where, you know, I saw that there were certain concepts, you know, particularly coming from Western psychology, which were quite difficult to understand.
That's so interesting to me, the whole idea of finding the concept of self-hatred incomprehensible.
Yes. and the psychologists, I mean, they were so sort of, you know, surprised and they were so amazed. And you know, after the conference was over, you know, they started asking me, you know, they were saying, does that mean, you know, no Tibetans suffer from self-hatred? Does that mean no Tibetans have low self-esteem? And I said, honestly, I don't know.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Welcome. It's my pleasure.
Geshe Thubten Jinpa is the chief translator for the Dalai Lama. He translated the Dalai Lama's new book, The World of Tibetan Buddhism, published by Wisdom Publications. This is Fresh Air. Weren't you stunned when you heard that the Dalai Lama couldn't comprehend the concept of self-hatred? Imagine the advice he could give Stuart Smalley. But to get back to the material world for a moment, I need to remind you that we're in the middle of a crucial fundraiser. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is facing budget cuts, and that means budget cuts for public radio stations. We need your support to keep the station going in spite of these cuts. Your pledge will also send a message that public radio is important. And right now, that's a very important message to send. Please call. Thank you very much. The 70s might be easing their way back into fashion. Music critic Milo Miles suggests that the best way to appreciate those years is to skip the period clichés and listen to the style of glossy soul that began in Philadelphia. Milo has a review of a new CD called If You Don't Know Me By Now, The Best of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes.
That we've been through, you should understand me like I understand you. Now, baby, I know the difference between right and wrong. I ain't gonna do nothing to upset our happy home.
The old line is that there are no second acts in American careers. But Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes hardly began until they were reborn. The group started as a doo-wop quartet in 1956 and recorded a local hit, If You Love Me, before Harold Melvin was even a member. Melvin reformed the Blue Notes after they hit the skids in the early 60s, but they sputtered along for almost a decade until they hired a drummer who could, you know, sing a little. This was Teddy Pendergrass, the most potent soul vocalist of his time next to Al Green. He proved to be such a charming romantic lead that he could spend much of his first crossover hit talking instead of singing.
I miss you, baby. I miss you, baby. I miss you, baby. Without you, I don't know what to do with myself, what to do with my time.
Hello?
Oh, no.
Did I disturb you?
What am I gonna do without you?
I mean to take up too much of your time, but just thought I'd give you a ring and see how you was doing.
As an ordained minister, Pendergrass was steeped in traditional gospel shouts. His up-tempo performances suggested a kinder, gentler Wilson Pickett. His downhearted ballads might have been a slightly more impersonal Jerry Butler. But he knew he operated at a time when urbane polyester was the mode. He was anything but a kid singing If You Don't Know Me By Now, and he was far from impoverished as he suffered through bad luck. The point was not money or age, but motion, getting ahead more than getting down, keeping clean as much as keeping up the struggle. Under Gamble and Huff, both the sound and the sentiment of the Blue Notes was an intriguing foretaste of the 1980s.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
On Philadelphia International Records, the strings and orchestration sound as spare as the clipped guitar riffs and tart horn licks on top of them. It's all dreamy and speedy at the same time. The resident philosopher with this swinging soapbox was songwriter Kenny Gamble. He reserved his heaviest polemics for another Philly international group, the OJs, and that mars a lot of their work for me. Gamble was a traditional family values man ahead of his time, and a fan of the current punitive take on morals, as in, we winners got 'em, you losers don't. Critic Robert Christgau nailed Gamble's downside, describing him as a gifted pop demagogue, black capitalist masquerading as liberator. Still, there's no question Gamble made a monumental production team with Leon Huff, and with songwriters Gene McFadden and John Whitehead around to lighten the atmosphere, the Blue Note's vitality sweeps away qualms.
Put your hands together. Clap along with the music. Uh-huh. The song is not a very hard one, you see. But I'd like everybody to listen to what I'm saying to you. You're the reason I wanna live, girl. I swear you're the reason.
Even though the Philly International years were by far the Blue Note's peak period, a truly comprehensive collection of that work has been very slow in coming. Well, as part of Columbia's Rhythm and Soul reissue series, we have If You Don't Know Me By Now, which really is the best of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Teddy Pendergrass was paralyzed from the neck down in a 1982 auto accident, and his hits have fallen off since then. If you don't know him by now, you should meet him first with the Blue Notes.
Milo Miles is a music writer based in Cambridge. He reviewed If You Don't Know Me By Now, the best of Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.